Thank you so much for listening to our sermon series on the Gospel of John entitled Come and See. We are so excited about what God is teaching us about himself and about us through his word and about the transformation that he is doing in us, making us more into the image of Jesus Christ. It is the prayer of Missio Church that this sermon might encourage you and strengthen you in your faith and trust in Jesus Christ. It is the desire of the elders of Missio Church that this sermon would not be used as a replacement or a substitute for you gathering with a local church and submitting to the leaders that God has put over your life. If we can help you in any way, please reach out to us at www.missiochurch.faith or by calling us 631-924-4943 anytime. You can also visit us on any Sunday at 10 a.m. at 70 Smith Road in Ridge, New York. We hope you enjoy today's message. All right, if you have a Bible, I hope you do. Turn to John chapter 20. John chapter 20. If you don't have a Bible, there should be one in the seat in front of you maybe, and the words will also be on the screen as well, so you can follow along either way. I don't know how you are, but when I watch a great movie, especially a true story, I really have to watch it to the very, very end. Like, I have to watch all the credits and everything because I want to make sure that I don't miss what happens in the future, right? Sometimes at the end of a movie, they'll tell you, right, kind of what happens, right? You know, you there's this kid early in the movie, and then they tell you at the end, okay, now the kid's a police officer, right? And or there was this young couple, right, that was just starting out. At the end, they say, well, now they have two kids and a dog, and you know, live in Maine, or maybe they're, you know, this convict was wrongly convicted, and at the end they say, you know, he's been released and he's at home with his family and things are back to kind of a normalcy in his life. Like, I like closure. I mean, I love a good story, but I like to kind of know what the final story is. I don't want to be left hanging to wonder, like, well, what happened? Like, even sometimes in fiction stories, I'm always like, well, but what happens next? Like, what happens after the movie is over? What happens after the credits roll? Because I like finality, but I also like hope. And I think that is why I love the end of the Gospel of John so much. Because it would seem like you would just end the story at the end of the resurrection account and be done, and Jesus alive, and that's it, and the story ends. But that's not what John does. John doesn't just end with the empty tomb. He doesn't just end with salvation being secured. He doesn't end with Jesus being alive. Instead, he ends by telling us about these disciples, which is so weird because they've been on this roller coaster of emotions for several chapters where they're sad Jesus is going to die, and then they're happy because he gives them the Spirit, and then they're sad because he's arrested, and then they're abandoning him while he's on trial, and then who knows where they are after he dies, and then they're overjoyed that he's alive, but they don't even know what to do about all those things. Even their own betrayal just sort of stands in front of them like a billboard saying, "You're not worthy to know Jesus." And so you can imagine they were probably wondering, like, well, wait a minute, it's great that the tomb is empty, but will Jesus still talk to us? Will Jesus still be with us? Will he provide for us? Will he help us? Will he forgive us? Because we have been the worst possible friends to him that there's ever been. So how is he going to respond to us? And the end of John gives us a miraculous story of how Jesus affirms to them that he does not treat them the way that they deserve to be treated. Instead, he treats them with kindness and grace and provision and forgiveness. The very things the resurrection is all about is what Jesus does after the resurrection for these 11 men. So after the resurrection, if you remember from last week, Jesus appeared to the disciples twice, that the day of the resurrection, and then a week later, he appeared to them. But now, John chapter 20 sort of jumps ahead. We don't even know what the timeline is. It's just several days later. And we know at this point that some of the disciples are eagerly worshiping Jesus, maybe just like we are. And Matthew chapter 28 says there's others who are doubting. Not that they're doubting his resurrection. They know he's alive. They just are doubting, like, what all this means. Like, what do we do about all these things? They're wrestling with their calling. They're wrestling with their disappointment that Jesus says he's leaving them. Their situation does not seem ideal. They have many questions. They have many fears. They have so much confusion. And what do they need to move forward? What do they need now to now fulfill the destiny that God has given to them? Well, what they need is they need the certainty that Jesus is near them. He cares for them. He supplies for their needs. He knows them. And he protects them. What the disciples need is exactly what you need. And that's why John gives us this conclusion of his gospel. So would you stand with me out of reverence for reading of God's word? And I'll start in John chapter 20, verse 30, and we'll go down to the end of chapter 21. Would you follow along as I read for us these words? It says, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which were not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Now after this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he revealed himself in this way. Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. And Simon Peter said to them, I'm going to go fishing. And they said to him, well, we'll go with you. And they went out and they got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. And just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore. Yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to them, children, do you have any fish? And they answered, no. And he said to them, well, cast your nets on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. That disciple whom Jesus loved, therefore, said to Peter, it is the Lord. And when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. The other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. When they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish that you have just caught. So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. And Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. Now none of the disciples dared to ask him, who are you? Because they knew it was the Lord. And so Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. And this was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And then he said to him again, feed my lambs. He said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And Jesus said to Peter, tend my sheep. And Jesus said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was grieved because he had said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted to go. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. And this he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after this, he said to him, follow me. And Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who also had leaned back against him during the supper and said, Lord, who is it that is going to betray you? And when Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? And Jesus said to him, if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is it to you? You follow me. So the saying spread among the brothers that this disciple was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? This is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things and who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true. Now there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose the world itself could not contain the books that would be written about him. Let's pray. God, thank you for your word, and thank you for the resurrected Jesus. May we trust him. May we rely upon him. May we follow him. For your glory, for our good, and for the benefit of others, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. You may be seated. So in the Gospel of John, as we've been studying this, it's been over a year we've been studying the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John is set up with what's called a very large chiasm from the beginning of the book to the end of the book. And a chiasm is just a fancy word that means that there are these related themes and ideas throughout the book that kind of form essentially one side of an X. The X is the Greek symbol for the letter chi. And so it's kind of like if you imagine kind of the one side of an X kind of like this. And so each one kind of indents itself, drawing attention to certain things, parallels, but also drawing a center to the center of the story. And so in the Gospel of John, it begins with God tabernacling among his people and being spirit-filled in chapter 1. And in chapter 20 and 21, we have now the temple of God is now in people. Jesus says, I'm filling you with my spirit. And so it begins and ends with the same theme. And then in chapter 2 to 4, we have these events of Jesus' ministry from Cana to Cana, where he does several miracles. He turns water into wine. He heals a sick person. He teaches, and that happens from Cana to Cana. And in chapter 18 to 20, we have these themes from garden to garden, right? We've been talking for several weeks how Jesus prays in a garden, he's arrested in a garden, he dies in a garden, he's resurrected in a garden. It's all about the garden because it's all about this new Eden, this new creation, this new life that comes in Jesus Christ. And then in chapters 5 through the end of chapter 11, we have Jesus in public among crowds and celebrating the Jewish feasts. And in chapters 13 to 17, we have Jesus in private with his disciples, but he only celebrates one feast, the Passover feast. And then in chapter 11, the end of chapter 11, one of the Pharisees says, or the chief priest says, right, it's better that one man dies in the whole world than the whole nation suffers. And in chapter 12, the end of chapter 12, Jesus enters into Jerusalem and says that he will die. It's a fulfilling prophecy. And in the center of this story of John in chapter 11, we have the rejection of Jesus at Passover, right? When the Jewish priests and the religious leaders and the political leaders, they want to kill Jesus, and you have the reception of Jesus by Mary anointing Jesus' feet. So you have these two contrasts with what do you do with Jesus? Do you reject him or do you receive him? Those are your choices. Well, so the end of John kind of also has a little chiasm that we're going to see here that draws our attention to the center, I think to the main point. We have two beginning and end. We have two bracketed concluding statements, and then we have two evidences of Jesus' sovereignty over the lives of his disciples, and then in the center, we have this restoration of Peter. Peter, do you love me? Peter, do you love me? And I think that that's the main point. But the first thing I want you to see is at the end of chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, I want you to notice the resurrected Jesus performed many verifiable signs, and the question for you is, do you believe him? Do you believe him? Now, some scholars say that the end of chapter 20 is actually the end of the Gospel of John because he has this purpose statement there. It just seems kind of like why would you insert it into the middle if this wasn't the end? But there's no evidence, if you go back to the earliest manuscripts, that John ever ended in chapter 20. All the manuscripts say that John ended in chapter 21. So it doesn't support that theory. But we do see here that John kind of summarizes everything that's been going on in the life of Jesus. And he says, listen, there are so many things that he did. They weren't all written in this book. But why were they all written? Why do we have the things that we have? We have the things that we have for two purposes. One is that you would believe in Jesus and that you would receive eternal life. That's why this is written. It's not written to establish some kind of revolution. It's not written for political purposes. It's not written for just this example of, hey, just do all these things and you'll go to heaven. It's written so you will believe in Jesus and that you'll have eternal life. That's why it's written. And every person, whether it's you or me or whether it's anybody in the world who hears the story of Jesus, we're all facing the same choice. Will we believe what's been written down? You say, well, but how do we know that any of this is verifiable? How do we know if any of this thing is even real? Well, there's more evidence for the life and the death of Jesus historically, not in the Bible, historically, than there is for just about any other known figure in the ancient world. Not just by a small margin, by a large margin. The Romans affirm that there was a man named Jesus who lived in Israel who died on a cross. The Jews affirm that there was a man who lived in Jerusalem and who died on a cross. You don't have to just go to the Bible. It's there. The evidence is there. The question is do you believe it? Do you believe it? Because if you believe it, there you find life. If you don't believe it, there is no life. So the resurrected Jesus has all these miracles that are there, that are verifiable for you. Do you believe in what he has written down for us? Second, we see the resurrected Jesus knows and cares and provides for the needs of the disciples and your needs. And the question is, will you look to him? Will you look to him? So the disciples left Jerusalem. And they return to Galilee, and now there's just seven of them. There were 11, now there's seven. I don't know what the other four are. Peter, Thomas, James, John, Nathaniel, and two guys that are not named. Gotta love to be those guys. I mean, throughout history, you're just known as the unnamed guys. And Peter decides he's going to go fishing. And then the other six follow him. And a lot of times, teachers will say, well, see, this is a sign, right? Peter did not really believe. Because he's abandoning Jesus. He went right back to fishing. Jesus is resurrected. He's not around for a day and a half. And Peter goes right back to what he used to do for. But John's focus is not on Peter going fishing or why he's going fishing. This is not a sign that Peter and the disciples have abandoned Jesus. This is a sign that Peter and the disciples have to eat. It's nothing more than that. It's just they have to eat. And what do you do when you have to eat, when you're a fisherman? You fish. And so they go out on the water, the Sea of Galilee, and they start to fish. And John draws our attention to the fact that they don't catch one single fish the entire night. Now, I do not fish. I don't even like to eat fish. But that's got to be pretty hard in that particular sea to be there all night and not catch a single fish in a net. You'd think like one little scrawny guy would at least, you know, fall into the net. You'd get one out. They get nothing for the span of close to 10 hours. And remember, these guys are not amateurs. They didn't rent a pontoon boat and get a $5 fishing rod from Walmart and a box of worms and say, let's go fishing. These guys are professionals. This is their livelihood. And so it's shocking that they don't catch any fish. And then someone in the darkness on the beach, that they can kind of see his silhouette, but they can't see who it is, calls out to them and says, children, do you have any fish? And the disciples don't recognize his voice. They don't see who it is. They just see there's someone out there. And the man says, do you have any fish? What's interesting is in the Greek it says, do you have one fish? Which is kind of a strange thing to ask. Like, well, why did you ask if I have one? That's what he asks. He says, do you have one fish? And I think the question is designed to reveal the difficulty of the situation. Because the disciples know they don't have any fish. So like they're the worst fishermen in Galilee right now. Right? This is a competition. They lose. And so Jesus asked them this. But what's interesting is that Jesus didn't ask them because he doesn't know. Jesus knows they don't have a single fish. And we know that because of what happens in a second. He knows they don't have any fish. He knows their situation. He knows they're hungry. He knows that they lack. He knows that apart from them, they can do nothing. And so he's asking them a question to raise an important issue. When Jesus' people need something, only Jesus can provide. And this is true for me and for you. You will be tempted to secure all kinds of things in your life on your own. Without asking for Jesus, without trusting Jesus, without depending upon Jesus, you will seek to live your life disconnected from Jesus. And you will discover that you cannot do anything apart from Jesus either. But the beauty is that Jesus knows what you need before you ask it. He knows your needs better than you do. He can provide for your needs better than you can. And so Jesus is the one that you're supposed to look to. Because he cares for you, and he provides for you, and he knows you. So the disciples answer back to Jesus, honestly, they go, we have not caught one fish. They are completely unable to provide for themselves a meal. They are helpless. And then Jesus says to them, well, just cast your nets on the other side of the boat, and you'll find something. Again, I'm not an expert fisherman, but I'm pretty sure just simply changing the location of where you drop your line or your net is not going to produce fish miraculously. Now, in the ancient Greek world, the right side was considered the side of good luck. So all you left-handed people, I'm sorry, the Greeks would look down upon you. The right side was good luck. But that's not Jesus' point. Jesus is not saying, okay, let's try the lucky side. Jesus' point is that he is going to command these guys to do something. The question is, will they listen? And really kind of shockingly, they listen to the stranger's voice. I mean, listen, if I'm at work and some stranger comes up to me and starts telling me how to do my job, I'm probably going to ignore them. Right? Most of you would. You'd be like, what is it? This guy doesn't know what they're talking about. He doesn't know a sledgehammer from a jackhammer. Right? He can't offer any insight about what I'm doing on the work site or on the railroad or anywhere else. But the disciples, they do. Now, I don't know if it's because they were exhausted, because they've given up, because they have no other options, but they listen to the voice of Jesus, they throw the net on the other side, and then miraculously, the net is full. They can't even bring it into the boat. This is not good luck. This is not a better strategy that produced results. This is a miracle. Jesus is present, and Jesus provides for the disciples when they need it. Now, what's interesting is there's another story in the Gospel of Luke that tells a similar story about a miraculous catching of fish. It's much earlier in Jesus' ministry, so it's not the same event. But in that event, the disciples are out all night again. They don't catch any fish. They come in. Jesus teaches. Jesus tells Peter, let's go back out into the deep part of the sea, and let's catch again. And Peter's kind of like, Jesus, we were out all night. We didn't catch anything. He starts making excuses, but he kind of reluctantly obeys. Like, okay, fine, we'll go do it if you say so. And they go out and they drop the nets again. And what happens? They get so many fish in the net that not only do they get them into the boat, but the boat starts to sink. There's two of them. They start to sink and the nets are breaking. And so you have these two events that kind of bookend the story of Jesus. And I don't think it's ironic that John's telling this, because I think what he's trying to draw attention to that event as well. He wants us to look back at that and go, oh, wow, remember this happened again. And the disciples' response was kind of similar. And in that time, when Jesus fills those nets, Peter says to Jesus, I am such a sinner, I am not worthy to be in your presence. He can't even fathom to be around Jesus. Sometimes you are slow to obey, just like Peter. Jesus is commanding you things, and you make all kinds of excuses about why you can't do it. Or you look for loopholes of how you can avoid it. Or maybe you just don't care. But like the disciples who switch sides of the net, when Jesus tells you to do something, you do it. You say, well, I don't understand the point. You don't have to. There might not be a point. The point just may simply be, are you going to obey or are you going to disobey? That may be the only point. And Jesus is telling you, when he tells you to obey, you obey. So when he tells you, you tell the truth, you tell the truth. When he says to you, you don't hate people, you forgive them, well then you forgive people, even the most difficult people in your life. When he says to you, you don't sleep with someone that's not your spouse, then you don't sleep with someone your spouse. Yeah, but we love each other. Yeah, but we're going to get married. Yeah, but you just do it. You obey. Because Jesus is Lord. And he takes ownership over your care and he's your provider. And so you trust him and you look to him and you do what he says. Now, when you go back to the Luke story, I think that that's still in the mind of the disciples. I think they're remembering it. I think they're on that boat and they're going, we've seen this before. We've seen this before. Because when this happens, John looks out across that water, about 110, 20 yards. He looks over, he sees that guy in the distance. He can't make out his face. He doesn't know his voice. And he says, that is Jesus. Why? Because it's triggering his mind. We remember the last time we had a miracle of fish. It was Jesus then too. And that's John. John is a thoughtful, inquisitive, thinking guy. And some of you are like that, right? You have to think and decide and debate and argue and figure it out. And then you come to the right conclusion. I know the truth. And then some of you are like Peter. Peter, when he hears this Jesus, it says he throws back on his clothes. Now, I don't know how Peter's fishing, because let me tell you, I'm not fishing in the nude. I'm just telling you it right now. But apparently Peter has no clothes on. He puts back on his clothes, which seemed kind of weird. Puts back on his clothes and then jumps into the water. Now, Jewish people historically are not good swimmers. They don't like the high sea. They don't like to go on the ocean. I mean, I remember Paul getting the shipwreck. They don't like open water. They don't swim. And I've been a lifeguard. Let me just tell you something. You don't swim well in clothes. And you don't swim well in a robe. So I don't know how Peter thought this was a good idea. Maybe he thought Jesus is going to, like, you know, prop him up on the water. He's going to walk to him. But Peter impetuously just jumps in and swims to shore and leaves the other six. And then the other six drag the nets behind them. They can't even get into the boat. They drag the nets behind them in the boat to the shore. And they all arrive about the same time. And when they get onto the shore, we learn that this is not just about fish. Because Jesus has already told these disciples, you are going to be fishers of men. You are going to be harvesters of a harvest that I'm producing. And Jesus is going to save the people, and the disciples are going to bring them to him. And you see that here. Jesus gets the fish, and what do the disciples do? They bring the fish to Jesus. We're seeing a picture of what it's like to follow Jesus. And this is important for you. If Jesus called you, you, like John, are to evaluate the information, evaluate the facts, evaluate the evidence. You are to think and meditate and pray. And at the same time, you're to be like Peter, and you are to jump in with both feet, go full on and say, I'm following Jesus. It might look foolish to other people, but you are going to go after him. You are going to follow him because he is the king. And who else would you go to? Who else would you go to? Well, then we get to the center section. This is the center. And we see the resurrected Jesus rescues, restores, and releases people for ministry. Do you love Jesus? So all seven disciples make it to shore. And when they get to the beach, they see a charcoal fire. And again, you go, this seems really unimportant. But remember, we've only heard about a charcoal fire one other time in the Gospel of John. And that was when Peter followed Jesus to the trial. And Jesus is inside on trial, and Peter is standing outside in the courtyard next to a fire, and to charcoal fire, with all these other enemies of Jesus. Peter is getting security and comfort and warmth standing around the enemies of Jesus. And so here, Peter runs up on the beach, and what does he see? He sees a charcoal fire. And I don't know what was going through Peter's mind, but he probably is like, oh crud, I've seen this before. And he goes up and he stands next to Jesus, and then what does he see? He sees a fish and a piece of bread on that fire. They're hungry. They needed fish. They couldn't catch any. And this whole time, Jesus was cooking them a feast. And then he says to them, bring the fish, some of the fish you brought. Now, I love this because I think that what Jesus is doing, I think he is dignifying them. He is treating them with glory and splendor, even though they don't deserve it. I remember reading a book a few years ago called Toxic Charity. And one of the things they say in that book, they say that there were all these good intentions of these different organizations that would take like Christmas presents to needy families. Right, and they would show up and they'd drop all these just bags of presents to this doorstep. And he said one time, he goes, "Here, I remember walking in this house, dropping off all these presents, and the father who was standing in the background, this family's poor, they don't have a lot of money, the father's standing there, and as they come in the door, the father walks out the back door and leaves. And it wasn't because he was ungrateful. It was because in that act of charity, they treated this father as if he could never provide for his family without their help. And they emasculated him in such a way that he felt like he wasn't even a man and he could not bear to be in the presence of his own children. And I think Jesus is doing the exact opposite here. Because Jesus, instead of just saying to them, hey, you're helpless without me, here's your food, eat, I'll serve you only, he invites them to be part of it. He says, listen, you can contribute some fish. Do I need your fish? No. Do I need your help? Not really. But I'm going to let you help me. I'm going to let you be a part of what I'm doing. I'm going to let you participate. Why? Because I love you. And because I care for you. And I want you to be part of the action. And so what's funny is Peter then runs back to the boat, that net that the other six disciples could not pull to shore on their own, right? They pull behind the boat. Peter runs to that net, grabs the net himself, and pulls the whole thing back to the fire. Peter is a strong man. He may not be a football player or bodybuilder, but this guy is strong. He brings all these fish, and the text says he brought 153 of them. Now, there are a lot of people that say there's a lot of symbolism to the 153. I don't think there's any symbolism. I think it's just a number. I think it's just interesting that John takes the time to tell us that somebody counted the fish. I mean, that seems like such a guy thing to do, right? We want to know how big the fish are. We want to know how many we caught. And John tells us there's 153. Yeah, there's 149 bones over there. And there's four left in the fire. There's 153. But what's more miraculous is not the number, but what's miraculous is the nets never tear. Remember, in Luke 5, the nets break. But here, the nets don't tear. And so Jesus invites them. He says, come and eat. Earlier he said, come and see, come and follow, come. And he keeps inviting them, come. And he invites them to be part of what he's doing. I got to think that they never forgot this dinner. I remember being in seminary. It was, I think, my first year. And I got a note from the seminary president saying that the president of my college, Cedarville College, was going to be on campus. And they were going to have a meeting. And during their part of their meeting, they're going to break up for a little bit of time. They invited all the alumni from Cedarville to have dinner at the president's house. There was about maybe 12 of us, I think. I will never forget sitting at that table and listening to these guys talk theology and just run circles around us. And we're all sitting there, a bunch of, you know, green-eyed, just, you know, 22-year-old kids just mesmerized and just, you know, spilling stuff on ourselves and not knowing what to say. I mean, you don't want to ask questions. You don't look like an idiot in front of the president. So you just sit there and you smile and you nod. And when they say, hey, tell me what your name is, you tell. That's all you do. But you never forget it. And these guys don't forget this dinner because they eat breakfast with Jesus. The guy that was dead a couple of days before, they get to eat breakfast. And what's interesting is John tells they still have questions. They're still confused. None of them dared to ask if it was Jesus. Like, I appreciate that because they don't have all the knowledge. They don't have everything they need to know. They're not certain, but they know that it was Jesus. They knew. They don't know how. They know he was in the tomb. They know he's not. They don't know how he got from here to there, but they know it's him. And what's Jesus doing? Jesus is the King of Kings. Jesus is the Lord of Lords. And what is he doing? He is cooking and he is serving his disciples. The greatest man on the beach, the greatest man in the world, is serving his disciples like a waiter. And you are not greater than Jesus. Yet some of you think serving is beneath you. You just want Jesus to serve you. But you don't want to serve other people. You're not willing to make a meal for someone. You're not willing to help someone who's sick. You're not willing to help someone with a problem at their house. You're not willing to serve children in our nursery. I was listening to a guy this week. He said that he wrote an article a couple of years ago. He said it was why he's a seminary professor, and he pastors a church. And he said, I wrote an article about men serving the nursery. And he said to the men in his church, said, if you do not serve in the nursery, if you are not willing to pick up sticky and soggy Cheerios and tell a child about Jesus and sing songs with them, if you're not willing to do that, you are never qualified to ever serve in the local church. Because if you can't serve the least of these, you can't serve anybody else. And I think that's what Jesus is saying to them. He's giving them the example. I'm serving you, and he wants them to serve other people. And so sitting around this fire, Jesus then begins to ask Peter a couple of questions. And if you remember when he was around the fire before, he got asked three questions, right? Do you know Jesus? No. Do you know Jesus? No. Do you know Jesus? No. Now he's sitting on this fire, and Jesus comes to him, and he says, Simon, do you love me? He says, do you love me more than these? Now, the these is confusing. It could be, do you love me more than the fish? Could be, do you love me more than you love those disciples? Because he does love them. Or it could be, do you love me more than the disciples love me? Now, either way, all of that provides some interesting discussion. I think it's the last. Do you love me more than these other disciples? I know that seems like kind of a weird question for Jesus to ask. But remember, just a second ago, when Peter thought that he saw Jesus on the beach, what does he do? He jumps in the water. And what do the other six do? They don't do anything immediately. Right, so Peter makes this grand gesture of his love and his affection and his desire to be with Jesus. He jumps in, and it's like Jesus saying, do you think you love me more than everybody else loves me? And Peter says, well, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. As if Peter's saying, why are you even asking me this? And then Jesus says to him, feed my lambs. Now, Jesus doesn't have literal lambs. He's not a literal shepherd. He's a literal carpenter, but he's a figurative shepherd. He is the great shepherd. And when he says, feed my lambs, he's talking about, I think, his young followers of Jesus. He's talking about his young people. You feed them. And what does it mean to feed them? It means to provide for them. It means to teach them, to care for them. You feed my lambs. Just like I'm feeding you physically, Peter, right now with these fish, you feed my people spiritually. You teach them about me. You love them. You care for them. And then Jesus says to him again, he goes, Simon, do you love me? And Peter goes, well, of course, Jesus, you know that I love you. And then Jesus says, well, then shepherd my sheep. He doesn't change, he changes the noun a little bit, lambs to sheep, but the primary change is shepherd. He is feed and shepherd. Shepherding is caring for the people. Right? It's the word that we get pastor from. Pastor in the New Testament really isn't a noun. We talk about it like it's a noun, right? I'm the pastor, he's a pastor. But really, for the most part, pastor in the Bible is a verb. It's something that you do. You pastor people, you shepherd people. So he's not calling Peter to an office. Contrary to what the Catholic Church says, this is not Jesus raising up Peter and going, you are the first pontiff. It's not a title. It's a function. You shepherd my sheep. You care for my sheep. And then Jesus says to Peter again, Simon, do you love me? And this time Peter is grieved. And I don't think Peter is grieved because Jesus keeps asking him. I don't think Peter's saying, Jesus, I told you, I love you, stop asking me. I think he's grieved because he knows at that very moment, I deny Jesus three times. I keep saying I love him, and Jesus knows what I did. He knows my betrayal. He knows how I did not testify to him. And Peter goes, Lord, you know everything. In other words, you know my past. You know my immediate past. You know my present. You know my failings. You know it all, Jesus. You know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus says to Peter, feed my sheep. I think that what Jesus is telling Peter is this. He's saying, Peter, if you love me, your love is made manifest and made known, not by your declarations of words to me. It's not made by your actions of seeming sacrifice for me and jumping to the water. Your love for me is seen in whether or not you love me. The people of the church. Because if you don't love them, you don't love me. If you don't shepherd them, you don't love me. If you don't serve them, you don't love me. If you don't teach them, you don't love me. It doesn't matter what you say. We Bible teachers spend a lot of time talking about the two different kinds of love in this passage, because the first two times it's Peter, do you agapo me? And then Peter says, I phileo you. And Jesus says, do you agape me? He says, I phileo you. And then Jesus changes it to, do you phileo me? And he says, yes, I do. Two different kinds of words. Agape is divine love. Typically, phileo is brotherly love. There's a small distinction between the two. But in the Bible, both words are used for God's love for Jesus. Jesus agapes Jesus. God the Father agapes Jesus. And God the Father phileos Jesus. So I don't think the issue here is the kind of love. But even if it is, even if Jesus is saying, will you give me this divine love? And Peter goes, no, I'll give you brotherly love. Even if that's what he's saying, notice at the end, Jesus accommodates Peter. Because he says, okay, fine, will you show me brotherly love? He condescends himself to Peter. He comes close to Peter. He knows Peter can't do what he's asking. And so he comes close to Peter and says, okay, fine, will you love me like a brother? And I think Jesus is reminding you, if you love Jesus as much as you claim on your Facebook page, if you love Jesus as much as your bumper stickers say, if you love Jesus as much as you sing in this church, if you love Jesus, it is revealed in how you serve and care for other people. And if you are not willing to serve others, you can say to me all day long, I love Jesus, and it's not true. Like Peter, you are called to action. You are called to feed and shepherd and engage the local church, to care for people just as Jesus cared for you. You cannot love Jesus and hate the church. Jesus says that he is the head of the church. So if you hate the church, then you hate Jesus' body. It'd be like a husband saying to his bride, listen, I really love you, but I sure think you're the ugliest thing in the world. And I hate your body. And I hate your face. And I hate your eyes. And you go, you don't love your wife. And the same thing is true for us. If we say that we love the head, then we need to love the church, just as Christ loved us. Fourth, the resurrected Jesus knows, preserves, and protects the future of his disciples. Do you trust him with your future? Jesus and Peter get up from that breakfast. They start to walk. And Jesus tells Peter where his future lands. He says, Peter, you are going to be taken where you don't want to go. Your hands will be spread out, and you are going to suffer. And what Jesus is saying to Peter is how he's going to die. And most traditions say that Peter died on a cross upside down. And Jesus tells Peter exactly what is going to happen to him. And by all worldly standards, Peter's life looks bleak, and it looks like it's going to be cut short, and it looks like it's going to be a waste. A 35-year-old man dead on a cross. And maybe you would feel like that too if your life got cut short like that, or if your children's lives got cut short like that. What a waste. And then Peter hears those words. And Jesus says to him, after telling him his future is that he's going to die, look what Jesus says to Peter. He says, Peter, follow me. He tells him up front, it's going to be hard. It's not going to be easy, but follow me. And we know that Peter died a martyr's life. We knew his life was hard. It was difficult. But Peter says in his own letter in chapter 1, he says, it's a gracious thing when mindful of God that one endures sorrow while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it when you sin and are beaten for it? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure. This is a gracious thing in the sight of God. That's what Peter's life is. And he was willing to face it head on. Your life may not be easy, but your life is sovereignly known and protected by God. But then Peter looks at John behind him and goes, okay, well, geez, what about that guy? Tell us what's going to happen to that guy. And that's often what we do, especially guys, right? We want to know what's going to happen to somebody else because we're fair. We want to know what the fair thing is. So if I'm going to suffer and die, then tell me how this guy's going to suffer and die. And Jesus says to Peter, basically, it's not your concern. You don't need to know what's going to happen to John. If I want to let John live forever, that's my prerogative. If I want him to die tomorrow, that's my prerogative. You follow me. You follow me, Peter. And listen, some of you are going to face some very difficult things in your life. Some of you are going to face sickness and disease and suffering, and it's going to be hard on you. And others around you are going to have nothing. They're going to live to be 105, and they're going to have a disease at all. Some of you are going to have suffer great financial hardship and anguish in this world. And others of you are going to have an abundance of resources, and you're never going to wonder where a meal's going to come. Following Jesus is not a one-size-fits-all thing. We don't all have the same journey, but we do have all the same destination. And Jesus is sovereign over both. He's sovereign over the suffering of Peter, and he's sovereign over John's lack of suffering. He's sovereign over the sickness that you face, and he is sovereign over the health that someone else has. He is sovereign over the successes that you have, and he's sovereign over the difficulties that your neighbor has. So we don't live comparing ourselves to other people. We don't live looking at others going, well, it's not fair, or why do I have to go through this, or why do they experience this? We look at it and we say, listen, I've been given a choice. I can follow Jesus wherever he leads, and whatever the difficulty is, and know that he is with me and will protect me and keep me to the end and give me eternal life when I die, or I can walk away. Those are my choices. And Jesus wants you to hold on to the fact that he has sovereign control over your life. Nothing happens in your life that Jesus did not know about, that Jesus didn't take an account for, that Jesus is not going to redeem through his resurrected life. Listen, I get it. My wife, terribly sick. Terribly sick. But we trust God in the sickness. Things happen, right? I didn't want to get a call from Alex that my daughter was in a bus accident. Totally disrupted our lives. But God knew. And God had everything taken care of before we ever got there. I didn't want my dad to get sick and die of leukemia again. Get sick again, and then die of leukemia. He didn't die and rise. He gets sick, got better, died. I didn't want that. Ron didn't want his mom to get cancer, but Jesus is sovereign over all of it. He knows. He has a purpose. So it doesn't matter what happens to someone else. It doesn't matter what their outcome is. You follow Christ and know you are in the palm of his hand and he will never let you go. And then lastly, at the end of the chapter, we see the resurrected Jesus testifies the truth and the world cannot contain it. Do you believe in him? John says, if they were to write all the things that Jesus said down, the world would run out of ink and run out of books. Now, there's a classic hymn called The Love of God that captures this sentiment in its third verse. It's probably not original to the author. I think he plagiarized it from someone else. But he says, could we with ink the ocean fill and were the skies of parchment made, were every stalk on earth a quill and every man a scribe by trade to write the love of God above would drain the ocean dry, nor could the scroll contain the whole, though stretched from sky to sky. O love of God, how rich and pure, how measureless and strong, it shall forevermore endure the saints and angels' song. It is impossible to tell all that Jesus did. It is impossible to praise his name enough. Our hearts, our words, our lives, we try, but we cannot. But Jesus testified to the truth, and we are to testify to Jesus. We are to make him known to every person and in every place that we go that Jesus Christ, just as John saw and as John wrote down, he was crucified, he was dead, but he is alive. You know, I think the conclusion of John is intentional because you have three of the worst experiences of Peter's life that are almost rehashed at the end. He doesn't trust Jesus in Luke 5 when they're fishing. He denies Jesus at the trial, and he doesn't stay with Jesus at his crucifixion. And Jesus addresses all of them, and he addresses them with grace and forgiveness because the resurrection of Jesus overwhelms the worst part of Peter's failure. You see, the story of Jesus does not conclude with the empty tomb. It continues in the hearts and lives of people, you and me and us, as we trust in Jesus to provide for us, knowing he is always near and that he'll care for us deeply and he'll reveal his love for us and bringing us to know him personally and deepening that love as we shepherd and serve and feed his sheep. Jesus knows our future. He controls our future, and we are to testify to his life. The resurrection is not the end. It was just the beginning of an abundant life, a forgiveness of sins, a ministry to others, and the hope of knowing that even if some form of cancer ravages your body, if some maniac driver plows into the passenger side of your car, or some tyrant takes you where you don't want to go and stretches your arms out and nails you into a cross, Jesus is in control. And Jesus wins, and he knows the future, and nothing can snatch you out of his hand. The best of days, the worst of days, every day. That is the hope of the gospel of Jesus Christ, crucified, buried, and resurrected. And that is good news.